A burst of light reveals a woman in a white classical robe with a blue stole draped over her arm. Standing on top of a shallow pyramid of steps, she holds a blazing torch in her right hand. The logo of Columbia, a Sony Pictures Entertainment Company. A family run down a path. The picture in an oval frame becomes the oval-shaped skin of a drum being banged by a small girl. The logo of Mandate Pictures. Under a starry sky, the Earth appears in sharp focus. The camera zooms into an American city in the morning. In a bedroom, the face of a wristwatch glows blue as its alarm goes off. A tall man in his late 30s with light brown curly hair reaches out and turns it off. Other events happen just as the narrator describes.
This is a story about a man named Harold Crick and his wristwatch. Harold Crick was a man of infinite numbers, endless calculations and remarkably few words. And his wristwatch said even less. Every weekday, for 12 years, Harold would brush each of his 32 teeth 76 times. 38 times back and forth, 38 times up and down. Every weekday, for 12 years, Harold would tie his tie in a single Windsor knot instead of the double, thereby saving up to 43 seconds. His wristwatch thought the single Windsor made his neck look fat, but said nothing.
Superimposed graphics reinforced the numbers.
Every weekday, for 12 years, Harold would run at a rate of nearly 57 steps per block for six blocks, barely catching the 8:17 Kronecker bus. His wristwatch would delight in the feeling of the crisp wind rushing over its face.
Holding a large green apple in his mouth, Harold Crick runs for the bus, arriving just in time to board before the doors close.
And every weekday for 12 years, Harold would review 7.134 tax files as a senior agent for the Internal Revenue Service.
Correct section 1.469-2BI. Thanks.
A colleague calls as Harold passes.
Harold, 89 times 1,417.
126,113. That adds
up. Only taking a 45.7-minute lunch break and a 4.3-minute coffee break, timed precisely by his wristwatch. I
will take Jake. Oh, great. Yeah, we'll go to Mullins.
Beyond that, Harold lived a life of solitude. He would walk home alone. He would eat alone.
Harold tidies up in his pristine beige kitchen, goes into his pristine beige bedroom and gets into his single bed.
And at precisely 11:13 every night, Harold would go to bed alone, placing his wristwatch to rest on the nightstand beside him. That was, of course, before Wednesday. On Wednesday, Harold's wristwatch changed everything.
A father uncovers his young son's eyes to reveal a brand new chopper bicycle. The boy hugs his dad. A black woman in her 20s circles jobs in the classified column of a newspaper. Harold Crick cleans his teeth in his bathroom.
If one had asked Harold, he would have said that this particular Wednesday was exactly like all the Wednesdays prior. And he began it the same way he...
Harold takes the toothbrush out of his mouth and listens.
And he began it the same way he always did.
He looks at his toothbrush.
Hello?
He puts it to his ear and shakes it.
He began it the same way he always did. When others' minds would...
Hello, is someone there?
He turns round and looks down the hallway, then carries on brushing.
When others' minds would fantasize about their upcoming day or even try to grip onto the final moments of their dreams, Harold just counted brush strokes.
All right, who just said Harold just counted brush strokes? But how do you know I'm counting brush strokes? Hello?
Harold dresses.
It was remarkable how the simple, modest...
He looks around.
It was remarkable how...
Tying his tie, he pauses.
It was remarkable how the simple, modest elements of Harold's life, so often taken for granted, would become the catalyst for an entirely new life. Harold ran for the bus, his stiff leather shoes making a terrible squeaking sound as they flexed against the asphalt.
Pausing to look at his shoes, Harold misses the bus. So does a woman.
And though this was an extraordinary day, a day to be remembered for the rest of Harold's life, Harold just thought it was a Wednesday.
I'm sorry, did you hear that? The voice, did you hear it? Harold just thought it was a Wednesday.
Don't worry, it is Wednesday.
No, did you hear it? Harold just thought it was a Wednesday.
Who's Harold?
I'm Harold.
Harold, it's okay. It's Wednesday.
No, never mind.
Later, he gets up from his work cubicle.
Harold couldn't concentrate on his work.
Excuse me, Harold?
His thoughts were scattered, his mind elsewhere.
Sorry.
Someone here should be able to fix... Hold on a second. Hey, Harold, what's 67 times 453?
When a co-worker asked the product of 67 and 453...
You know what? I can't think while you're talking.
He drew a blank.
What?
Harold quickly answered...
Nothing.
30,351. Despite the answer really being 31,305.
Wait. 31,305. Sorry.
Later, Harold is in a room lined with boxes.
Dude, I just totally caught some insurance adjuster claiming his jet ski as a work vehicle.
I tell you, it is a shame that they don't give out an Auditor of the Year award.
Bespectacled Dave looks up at Harold.
Dude? You okay?
Dave, I'm being followed.
Dave glances over his shoulder.
How are you being followed? You're not moving.
It's by a voice.
What?
I'm being followed by a woman's voice.
Oh. Okay. What is she saying?
She's narrating.
Oh.
Dave waits awkwardly.
Harold, you're staring at boxes. What is she narrating?
No. I had to stop filing. Watch. Listen.
He files.
The sound the paper made against the folder had the same tone as a wave scraping against sand. And when Harold thought about it, he listened to enough waves every day to constitute what he imagined to be a deep and endless ocean.
Did you hear that? You mean you're filing?
No, the voice.
No. Frightening part is sometimes I do imagine a deep and endless ocean.
What ocean?
The one made by the sun.
Forget it.
No audits. Have a good day.
Thank you.
A woman comes and goes.
All right, we got a baker and a securities trader. Maybe you should take the baker. Okay.
In a bakery and coffee house, a dark-haired, tattooed girl baker in headscarf, T-shirt and jeans needs a lump of dough.
Damn it! You miscreant!
I understand.
Oh, get bent! Taxman!
The customers and staff point accusingly at Harold.
Is there somewhere else we could talk about this?
No. We're gonna talk about this right here.
Okay. It says, file that you only paid part of your taxes for last year.
That's right.
Looks like only 78%.
Yeah.
So you did it on purpose?
Yep.
So you must have been expecting an audit.
I was expecting a fine. Or a sharp reprimand.
A reprimand? This isn't boarding school, Miss Pascal. You stole from the government.
No, I didn't steal from the government. I just didn't pay you entirely.
Miss Pascal, you can't just not pay your taxes.
Yes, I can.
You can if you want to get audited.
Only if I recognize your right to audit me, Mr. Crick.
Miss Pascal, I'm right here auditing you. I now have to go over your past 3 years' return to make sure that's all you haven't paid.
Fine. Actually, you know, it's not fine. Listen, I'm a big supporter of fixing potholes and erecting swing sets and building shelters. I am more than happy to pay those taxes. I'm just not such a big fan of the percentage that the government uses for national defense, corporate bailouts, and campaign discretionary funds. So I didn't pay those taxes. I think, actually, I sent a letter to that effect with my return.
Would it be the letter that begins, "Dear imperialist swine"?
Yes.
Miss Pascal, what you're describing is anarchy. Are you an anarchist?
You mean, am I a member?
An anarchist group, yes.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
They assemble?
I don't know.
Wouldn't that completely defeat the purpose?
It was difficult for Harold to imagine Ms. Pascal as a revolutionary.
Not now.
Her thin arms,
what?
Hoisting protest signs,
huh?
Her long, shapely
Nothing.
Legs dashing from tear gas. Harold wasn't prone to fantasies, and so he tried his best to remain professional, but of course failed. He couldn't help but imagine Ms. Pascal stroking the side of his face with the soft blade of her finger. He couldn't help but imagine her immersed in a tub, shaving her legs. And he couldn't help but imagine her naked, stretched across
Mr. Crick.
His bed.
Mr. Crick.
Yes, what is it?
You're staring at my tits.
I don't think I would do that. If I was, I can assure you it was only as a representative of the United States government. Sorry, I'm having issues today, so I'll be back on Tuesday.
He leaves.
Harold suddenly found himself, beleaguered and exasperated, outside the bakery.
Shut up!
Cursing the heavens in futility.
No, I'm not. I'm cursing you, you stupid voice, so shut up and leave me alone!
A woman stands on the ledge of a building 12 floors above a street. She holds a cigarette in one hand and holds out the fingers of her other hand to see if she's trembling. On the corner below, a man is hosing down the pavement. The woman circling job advertisement stops close by just as the boy rides by on his bike. In trying not to splash the boy, the street cleaner splashes the trousers of the woman.
Hey, watch it!
On the top of the building, the woman, in her mid-40s with short, uncombed brown hair, high cheekbones and no makeup, takes the barely smoked cigarette from her mouth. She spits into a tissue that contains another barely smoked cigarette, extinguishes the first one in the spittle, folds the tissue and slips it into the pocket of her shapeless black cardigan. Her wide mouth sets determinedly. Her eyes widen, and she steps off the edge of the building.
Oh! Excuse me. Excuse me.
The would-be suicide is standing on her desk in her large minimalist white apartment.
Are you Miss Eiffel?
She eyes the intruder with hostility.
Yes. Excellent. May I ask what you're doing?
Research.
Oh, am I interrupting?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm Penny Escher. I'm the assistant your publisher's hired.
The spy?
The assistant. I provide the same services as a secretary.
I don't need a secretary.
Well, then I will have to find some other way of occupying my time.
You're like watching me like a vulture in case I get distracted because they, the publishers, think I have writer's block. Isn't that right?
Do you have writer's block?
Miss Eiffel turns away. Penny looks at the desk.
Are these pages?
They're letters. To me.
Are you writing back?
I don't respond to letters.
And I suppose you smoked all these cigarettes?
No, they came pre-smoked.
Yeah, they said you were funny.
Penny, a sturdy young black woman, looks up at Miss Eiffel, who's looking pensive.
What do you think about leaping off a building?
I don't think about leaping off a building.
Yes, you do.
No, Trying to think of nice things.
Everyone thinks about leaping off a building.
Well, I certainly don't think about leaping off of a building.
Miss Eiffel, looking at the pinstriped intruder with contempt, crouches down, picks up another cigarette, and lights it.
They say...
Penny thumps her briefcase on the desk.
I read this in this fantastically depressing book. That when you jump from a building, it's really the impact that actually kills you.
Well, I'm sure it doesn't help.
There's a photograph in the book called The Leaper. It's old, but it's beautiful. From above the corpse of a woman who just leapt to her death. There's blood around her head, like a halo, and her legs buckled underneath, her arms snapped like a twig, but her face is so serene, so at peace. And I think it's because when she died, she could feel the wind against her face.
Miss Eiffel puts her hands on her cheeks and slowly bends over as if toppling.
I don't know how to kill Harold Crick. That's why they sent you.
Yes, to help you.
How are you going to help me? You, who never thinks of leaping off buildings. What great inspiration will you bestow on me? Because I'll tell you, the quaint ideas I'm sure you've gathered in your adorable career as an assistant are to no avail when faced with killing a man.
I understand. Do you?
I can't just...
Miss Eiffel drinks from a bottle of water and sits on the windowsill.
As much as I would like to, I cannot simply throw Harold Crick off a building.
Penny pointedly holds out an ashtray. Miss Eiffel pointedly flicks her ash on the floor. Penny nods.
Miss Eiffel? Kay? I've been an author's assistant for 11 years. I've helped more than 20 authors complete more than 35 books, and I've never missed a deadline. And I've never gone back to the publisher to ask for more time. Now, I will be available to you every minute of every day until the final punctuation is embedded on the very last page. I do not like loud music. I do not abide narcotics. And I will gladly and quietly help you kill Harold Crick.
At work, Harold gets an email from Dr. Cayley in Human Resources suggesting a chat. Cayley is bearded with a rabbit's tooth round his neck.
I had a very interesting little convo with someone in your section.
Yeah?
They said you were feeling a little wibbly-wobbly.
Oh.
Catch a little cubicle fever?
Oh, I don't know. I think I'm okay.
Harold, a tree doesn't think it's a tree. It is a tree.
Why was Harold talking to this man?
I know that you know.
This man was an idiot.
We're very sensitive about
this
any
man
possible
used words like wibbly wobbly and convo.
I think we all remember the Baltimore.
And explained that trees
and
were
the
trees.
The U.S. government.
Of
really
course, trees were trees.
Kind of emotional movement.
Harold knew.
But
trees
I
were trees.
Am going to believe you. Harold?
What Harold didn't know was why he couldn't shake the smell of brownies from his senses. Why Ms. Pascal had made his fingertips quiver and lips go numb.
Harold?
Huh? Yes. Sorry.
What's going on, Harold?
Cayley sits closer.
Well... nothing. Everything's fine.
Cayley goes back to his desk.
Listen, according to your records, you haven't taken vacation in a few years now. Let's say you take a little break. Use some of that vacay time.
Yeah. I'll think about it.
Harold nods at the shaggy bespectacled knitwear-wearing analyst and gets to his feet.
Harold. I'm not really supposed to do this. But,
He puts his arms around Harold. Harold endures the hug without responding. Sometime later, Harold stands in a queue waiting for a bus. His wristwatch lights up. It spots Anna, the baker, walking on the other side of the street, and random symbols start flashing across its illuminated blue face.
Harold assumed his watch was simply on the fritz and never even considered that it might be trying to tell him something.
Anna walks on by, not having seen Harold.
In fact, Harold had never once paid attention to his watch other than to find out the time. And honestly, it drove his watch crazy. And so on this particular Wednesday evening, as Harold waited for the bus, his watch suddenly
stopped.
He adjusts the watch.
Sorry, does anyone have the time?
I got 6:18.
Thanks.
Thus, Harold's watch thrust him into the immitigable path of fate. Little did he know that this simple, seemingly innocuous act would result in his imminent death.
What? What? Hey! Hello? What?
A bus pulls up.
Why? Why my death? Hello? Excuse me? When? How imminent? Okay, where are you?
At home, Harold rushes into the bathroom and grabs his toothbrush. He squeezes out some toothpaste and starts to brush.
Harold would brush 32 teeth 72 times. Why won't you say anything? I heard you. That would result in his imminent death. I heard you! Come on, you stupid voice. Harold frantically grabbed his lamp. Harold incensed, shook the hell out of it for no apparent reason. Dashed it on the ground, kicking it repeatedly. Harold took his Kleenex bottle, threw it across the room, then stormed the closet!
He ransacks his shelf units.
Something! Say something! Say something!
His fury becomes raw anxiety as he stands before his reflection in the mirror.
Harold, distraught.
He slumps on his bed.
God. Harold, distraught.
He tries to steady his breathing.
Harold.
Later, he's with an Elphick psychiatrist in her chrome and leather office.
I'm afraid what you're describing is schizophrenia.
No, it's not schizophrenia. It's just a voice in my head. I mean, the voice isn't telling me to do anything. It's telling me what I've already done. Accurately and with a better vocabulary.
Mr. Crick, you have a voice speaking to you.
No, not to me. About me. I'm somehow involved in some sort of story. Like I'm a character in my own life. But the problem is that the voice comes and goes. Like there are other parts of the story not being told to me. And I need to find out what those other parts are before it's too late.
Before the story concludes with your death?
Yes.
Mr. Crick, I hate to sound like a broken record, but that's schizophrenia.
You don't sound like a broken record, but it's just not schizophrenia. What if what I said was true? Hypothetically speaking, if I was part of a story, a narrative, even if it was only in my mind, what would you suggest that I do?
I would suggest you take prescribed medication.
Other than that?
I don't know. I suppose I would send you to see someone who knows about literature.
Okay. Yeah. It's a good idea. Thank you.
In a modern university.
So you're the young gentleman who called me about the narrator.
Yes.
And this narrator says you're gonna die.
Yes.
Uh-huh. How long has it given you to live?
I don't know.
Dramatic irony. It'll fuck you every time.
In the men's room.
So, you crazy or what?
Well.
Are you allowed to say that to crazy people?
I don't know.
Oh, well. How many stairs in the hallway out there?
What?
You were counting them as we walked, weren't you?
No.
Of course. What bank you working?
No bank, IRS agent.
Married?
No.
Ever?
Engaged to an auditor. She left me for an actuary.
How heartbreaking. Live alone?
Yes.
Any pets?
No.
Friends?
No. Well, Dave at work.
I see. The narrator, exactly what does he sound like?
It's a woman.
Huh?
A woman.
Is it a familiar woman?
No.
Someone you know?
In a corridor?
No.
Did you have enough time to count the tiles in the bathroom?
I wasn't counting the tiles.
Mm-hmm. Coffee?
No, thank you.
Sure?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, this woman, the voice, told you you're gonna die?
Well, she didn't tell me. She doesn't know I can hear her.
She said it.
Yes.
And you believed her.
Well, she's been right about a few other things.
Such as?
How I felt about work.
You dislike your work?
Yes.
Well, not the most insightful voice in the world, is it? First thing on the list of what Americans say they hate: work, second, traffic, third, missing socks. See what I'm saying?
Sort of.
I told you you're gonna die, you believe me?
No.
Why?
I don't know you.
But you don't know this narrator either.
Well.
Okay, Mr. Crick. I can't help you.
Why?
Well, I'm not an expert in crazy. I'm an expert in literature theory, and I gotta tell you, thus far, there doesn't seem to be a single literary thing about you. I don't doubt you hear a voice, but it couldn't possibly be a narrator because, frankly, there doesn't seem to be much to narrate. And beside that, this semester I'm teaching 5 courses, I'm mentoring 2 doctoral candidates, and I'm the faculty lifeguard at the pool.
Oh, I just thought you could possibly...
Perhaps you should keep a journal. Write down what she said or something. That's all I can suggest.
Harold stands in Dr. Hilbert's office doorway.
I can barely remember it all. I just remember little did he know that this simple, seemingly innocuous act would lead to his imminent death.
What?
Little did he know that
this...
Did you
say little did he know?
Yes.
I've written papers on little did he know. I used to teach a class based on little did he know. I mean, I once gave an entire seminar on little did he know. Son of a bitch, Harold. Little did he know means there's something he doesn't know. That means there's something you don't know. Do you know that? I want you to come back Friday.
Okay.
No, imminent. You could be dead by Friday. Come back tomorrow at 9:45.
10 seconds ago, you said you wouldn't help me.
It's been a very revealing 10 seconds, Harold.
On a bendy bus home, Harold transcribes the narrator's words.
Harold was deep in thought. For a few brief moments, from Bourne Boulevard to Euclid Avenue, all the calculations and all the rules and all the precision of Harold's life just faded away. How perfect, then, that in this space, Anna Pascal would appear.
Harold looks up.
Miss Pascal.
Anna retreats down the bus.
Miss Pascal, it's Harold Crick from the IRS.
Excuse me.
She looks at him awkwardly.
Hi.
Hi. Would you like a seat?
Nope.
There's 11 open ones.
I don't care.
The bus jerks forward and throws her into a seat near to Harold. He's in a sideways-facing seat directly over the bendy bit of the bus. Every time it turns a corner, his seat either turns its back on or turns to face Anna.
How are you?
I'm lousy. I'm being audited.
Of course.
By a real creep, too.
The bus turns a corner, and his seat swings him away from her. He twists round.
I think I owe you an apology.
Really?
IRS agents, we're given rigorous aptitude tests before we can work. Unfortunately for you, we aren't tested on tact or good manners, so I apologize. I ogled you. Sorry.
She purses her lips with the faintest of smiles and nods.
Okay, apology accepted. But only because you stammered.
Anna has dark brown hair cut in a bob, and she's wearing a striped top and a knee-length pleated skirt.
So you're a frequenter of the Metropolitan Transit Authority, too?
No. I'm just late.
Big flag burning to get to?
Actually, it's my weekly evil conspiracy and needlepoint group. You want to come?
I left my thimbles of socialist reading material at home.
She grins.
Harold nervously made small talk.
You have very straight teeth.
Very small talk.
Thanks. They're real.
Harold quickly calculated the odds of making an ass of himself in ratio to the amount of time he stayed to chat.
This is my stop. I should go.
He was elated and surprised by his somewhat flirtatious encounter with Miss Pascal. So elated, he exited the Transit Authority bus a good 27 blocks too early and would now have to walk.
One of the computer-like graphics showing the figures and calculations that pop unbidden into Harold's head now shows a map of the 27 blocks home. As he cleans his teeth that night, the graphic counting his brush strokes suddenly flashes up Anna. He sets his wristwatch, gets into bed, and turns off the light. The next day in his book-lined study at the university, Dr. Jules, addicted to coffee Hilbert, lies on a sofa watching a book program on TV.
Well, it's about being around in the world, doing different things, doing what you want to do.
Come in.
Harold tentatively opens the door.
Mr. Crick. Come in, please.
How are you?
I'm fine, actually.
You can turn that off. Looks like our narrator hasn't killed you quite yet.
No, not yet.
Great. Let's see. Cop the stairs outside?
No.
Of course not. I've devised a test. How exciting is that? Of 23 questions, which I think might help uncover more truths about this narrator. Now, Howard.
Harold.
These may seem silly, but your candor is paramount.
Okay.
So.
Hilbert eats some yogurt.
You know it's a woman's voice. The story involves your death. It's modern. It's in English, and I'm assuming the author has a cursory knowledge of the city.
Sure.
Okay, good.
Hilbert licks his fingers and looks at his notes.
Question one. Has anyone recently left any gifts outside your home?
Mm-mm.
Anything, gum, money. A large wooden horse.
I'm sorry?
Just answer the question.
No.
Okay. Do you find yourself inclined to solve murder mysteries in large, luxurious homes to which you... Let me finish. To which you may or may not have been invited.
No.
Right. On a scale of 1 to 10, what would you consider the likelihood you might be assassinated?
Assassinated?
1 being very unlikely, 10 being expecting it around every corner.
I have no idea.
Okay, let me rephrase. Are you the king of anything?
Like what?
Anything. King of the lanes at the local bowling alley.
King of the lanes?
King of the lanes. King of the trolls.
King of the trolls?
Yes. A clandestine land found underneath your floorboards. Anything?
No.
Huh?
No. It's ridiculous.
Agreed. But let's start ridiculous and move backwards. Now, was any part of you one time part of something else?
Like, do I have someone else's arms?
Well, is it possible at one time that you were made of stone, wood, lye, buried corpse parts, or earth made holy by rabbinical elders?
No, look. I'm sorry, but what do these questions have to do with anything?
Nothing. The only way to find out what story you're in is to determine what stories you're not in. Odd as it may seem, I've just ruled out half of Greek literature, 7 fairy tales, 10 Chinese fables, and determined conclusively that you are not King Hamlet, Scout Finch, Miss Marple, Frankenstein's monster, or a golem.
Harold listens with blank incomprehension.
Aren't you relieved to know you're not a golem?
Yes, I am relieved to know that I'm not a golem.
Good.
Dr. Hilbert picks up his notebook again.
Do you have magical powers?
Kay Eiffel is driving over a bridge in pouring rain. The boy with the chopper bike is riding on the bridge pavement. In the road, the black job-seeking woman is slowly driving a road sweeper along the curb. The boy swings off the pavement onto the road in front of Kay. Kay's car skids across the road, through the safety barrier, and into the river below. The car lands on its roof and sinks. Kay and Penny are sitting by the river looking over at the bridge. Penny is holding an umbrella. Kay is smoking and getting wet. There's no car.
May I ask what we're doing out here?
We're imagining car wrecks.
I see. We can't imagine car wrecks inside?
No. Did you know that 41% of accidents occur in times of inclement weather?
So 90% of pneumonia cases.
Really? Pneumonia? That's an interesting way to die. But how would Harold catch pneumonia?
Have you written anything new today?
No.
Did you read the poems I suggested, or did you make a list of words, buy a new type of paper, anything?
Nope, none of it.
Sitting in the rain won't write books.
Well, that illustrates exactly how much you know about writing books.
Kay, her hair drenched, puffs at the cigarette cupped in her hand. Penny fishes in her pocket for a leaflet.
What's this?
It's literature on the nicotine patch.
I don't need a nicotine patch, Penny. I smoke cigarettes.
Well, may help.
May help? Help what? Help what, Penny? Help write a novel?
May help save your life.
I'm not in the business of saving lives.
She spits into a tissue.
In fact, just the opposite.
And stubs the cigarette into the spittle. In Hilbert's office...
What's your favorite word?
Integer.
Good, good, good. Do you aspire to anything?
No.
Conquer Russia?
No.
Win a whistling contest?
No.
Harold, you must have some ambition.
I don't think so.
Some underlying dream. Think.
Well, I've always wanted my life to be more musical.
Like West Side Story?
No. Like...
What?
Well, I've always wanted to learn to play the guitar.
Dr. Hilbert crosses to his desk.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The last thing to determine conclusively is whether you're in a comedy or a tragedy. To quote Italo Calvino, the ultimate meaning to which all stories refer has two faces. The continuity of life, the inevitability of death. Tragedy, you die. Comedy, you get hitched.
He pours his mug of coffee back into the jug to warm it up.
Most comic heroes fall in love with people who are introduced after the story has begun, usually people who hate the hero initially, although I can't imagine anyone hating you, Harold.
Professor Hilbert, I'm an IRS agent. Everyone hates me.
Right, good. Have you met anyone recently who might loathe the very core of you?
I just started auditing a woman who told me to get bent.
Well, that sounds like a comedy. Try to develop that.
In Anna's bakery and coffee bar.
Four, please.
No, I didn't get my honey, honey.
Lulu, can you refill the honey for Larry? Quarters also.
Harold comes in. He has a notebook with pages marked comedy and tragedy.
Mr. Crick, you're here early. Must have a lot of people to extort.
No, just you.
Twig, tea, and banana bread.
Yes, ma'am.
Actually, it should only take the day to make sure 22% is all you owe.
Well, I won't be paying, no matter the percentage, Mr. Crick.
No, I know, but the percent determines how big your cell is.
He's made one mark under comedy, and getting absolutely no reaction, he makes one under tragedy.
You know, you can call me Harold.
Yeah, I know, but I don't want to.
Oh.
He makes another mark.
Mr. Amana.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. What is that? What are you marking?
Oh, this is nothing. Why don't we start with your backup documents and the receipts for the past 3 years?
Sure.
He follows her to an upstairs storeroom. She dumps a big cardboard box on the table.
What's this?
My files.
What?
My tax files.
You keep your files like this?
No, actually, I'm quite fastidious. I put them in this box just to screw with you.
She goes back downstairs. Harold sits down at the table and gets stuck in. Graphics showing his computations and form filling scatter across the screen. A little later, he comes down into the coffee shop just as Anna is greeting a customer.
Hi! How are you?
Oh, so how was it?
Miss Pascal, can I just ask you a question about this receipt?
It was fantastic.
Just wondering if this 9 is a 7.
And what did you do?
I call you a 10.
I'm
just going to guess it's a 7.
He makes a mark on the tragedy column in his notebook and goes back upstairs. Later, Anna appears to fetch some ingredients.
You need help with that?
A tramp-like customer comes upstairs.
I see the president. It's the taxman. Hello, Mr. Taxman.
Yeah.
You can call me Harold.
Okay.
Yeah, how the numbers going?
Pretty good.
Gotta find that 22%.
22%?
22. 11 times 2.
Okay.
It's prime numbers.
Yeah.
You gonna text the bathroom?
No, I'm not gonna text
the bathroom. Can I use the bathroom then?
Go for it.
Is that okay? Okay,
yeah.
All right. I'm gonna use the bathroom. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
At lunchtime, Harold sits on a bench at the side of Anna's bakery with a sandwich and a cup of takeaway coffee. As he gets up, he glimpses Anna through the circular window behind him. He stands gazing at her until she suddenly looks over at him and catches him staring. At the end of the day, in the storeroom above the shop, Harold shuts his briefcase and puts on his Mac. It's dark outside and raining. He comes downstairs past the notice board plastered with posters advertising alternative theatre performances, therapists, poetry readings, and acupuncturists in the city. Anna is behind the counter getting cookies out of the oven.
Well, good night.
Want a cookie?
Oh, no.
Come on. They're warm and gooey. They're fresh out of the oven.
No, I don't like cookies.
You don't like cookies?
She turns to face him.
What's wrong with you?
I don't know.
Everybody likes cookies.
No, I know.
After a really awful, no good day, didn't your mama ever make you milk and cookies?
No. My mother didn't bake. The only cookies I ever had were store-bought.
Okay. Sit down.
No, I'm...
No. Sit down.
He does, and she brings him a glass of milk and a cookie.
Now, eat a cookie.
I really can't.
Mr. Crick, it was a really awful day. I know. I made sure of it. So pick up the cookie, dip it in the milk, and eat it.
He picks the cookie off the plate, dunks it in the milk, glances up at her, and takes a tentative bite. Anna, in a cropped Chinese bolero over a white vest and dark jeans, watches as he closes his eyes and takes a deep, deep breath.
That's a really, really good cookie.
He finishes it off. She smiles, takes the plate, and brings more cookies.
Well, when did you decide to become a baker?
In college.
Oh, like a cooking college?
I went to Harvard Law, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just assumed it was...
No, it's fine. I didn't finish.
Something happened?
No. I was barely accepted. I mean, really, barely. The only reason they let me come was because of my essay. How I was going to make the world a better place with my degree. And anyway, we would have to participate in these study sessions. My classmates and I, sometimes all night long. And so I'd bake. So no one would go hungry while we worked. Sometimes I would bake all afternoon in the kitchen in the dorm. And then I'd bring my little treats to the study groups. And... people loved them. I made oatmeal cookies, peanut butter bars, dark chocolate macadamia nut wedges. And everyone would eat and stay happy and study harder and do better on the tests. And then more and more people started coming to the study groups. And I'd bring more snacks. And I was always looking for better and better recipes until soon it was ricotta cheese and apricot croissants. And mocha bars with an almond glaze and lemon chiffon cake with zesty peach icing. And at the end of the semester, I had 27 study partners, 8 mead journals filled with recipes, and a D average. So I dropped out. I just figured if I was going to make the world a better place, I would do it with cookies.
She focuses on Harold with her large, soulful eyes.
You like them?
I do.
I'm glad.
Thank you for forcing me to eat them.
You're welcome.
He gazes at her across the table, then glances down at his watch.
I should go. Oh, thank you for the cookies.
Why don't you take them home?
Oh, no.
Oh, come on.
No, really, please.
No, really, please.
No, really, please. I'd like to, but I can't.
You can't?
No. I mean, because, see, it constitutes a gift.
Oh.
Actually, I shouldn't have even had those other ones, so...
Okay. Well, I'm not going to tell anyone.
No, I know, but if you did...
Well, I'm not going to.
No, but if you did...
But you think I'm going to call
look,
the...
I'll purchase them. I'm happy to purchase them. How's that? And there are no issues.
She turns away, shaking her head.
What?
No.
Please. Why don't I just...
Go home.
No, it's really, it's not a big deal.
Go home.
Okay.
She wipes down her dough-making table.
Did you... You baked those cookies for me, didn't you?
She looks back at him, neither confirming or denying.
You were just trying to be nice, and I totally blew it. Oh, okay. This may sound like gibberish to you, but, I think I'm in a tragedy.
She looks at him sympathetically. In his notebook, the comedy page has 4 ticks. The tragedy page is covered in ticks. He adds another one. He leaves the shop, raises his umbrella, and walks off down the dark, wet pavement. In a university locker room, he watches with a look of faint disgust as bouffant-haired Dr. Hilbert puts his clothes in a locker, eats a banana, and then picks his teeth. Behind them, men sponge themselves off under a forest of chrome showers.
Professor Hilbert, I've totally failed at the comedy tragedy thing. In fact, I think she likes me even less.
I know it's great.
What do you mean?
You prove something else entirely. The voice seems to be dependent on actions you take. You reset your watch, it says you reset your watch. You ride a bus, it says you ride the bus. You brush your teeth, it says you brush your teeth. It may be that you yourself are perpetuating this story. So, I suggest we try something else.
Like what?
Try nothing. Nothing.
What about Miss Pascal?
Forget her.
Forget her? Other than numbers, she's all I think about.
Harold, if you want to stay alive, you try something else.
That something being nothing?
Nothing, exactly.
Nothing?
Let me explain this again. Some plots are moved forward by external events and crises. Others are moved forward by the characters themselves. If I go through that door, the plot continues. The story of me through the door. If I stay here, the plot can't move forward. The story ends. Also, if I stay here, I'm late.
Hilbert comes through to the swimming pool.
Don't do anything tomorrow.
Nothing?
Nothing. Stay home. Don't answer the phone. Don't open the door. Don't brush your teeth.
What about work?
Call him tonight. Tell him you're not coming.
Don't go to work?
Don't do anything that may move the plot forward. Instead, let's see if the plot finds you. Marshall, you're not kicking.
Lifeguard Dr. Hilbert hurries off. At home, Harold sleeps fully clothed on his sofa in front of the TV. Close to his feet is a cool box and a plate of snack food. As he sits up, several of his mental icons appear. The toilet icon flashes. He reaches under the coffee table for a bottle.
To similar bodies of water, I fell. Perhaps it is the familiarity alone that keeps them here. Or perhaps it is an unwillingness to lose the collective memory of the once beautiful hills that surround the lake.
And it takes only seconds for the fiddler crabs to realize that the waiter they might once have feared has now become their prey.
Harold goes to switch off, but stops himself.
The wounded bird knows its fate. Its desperate attempts to escape only underscore the hopelessness of its plight.
Time passes. The TV shows a boatload of monkeys in cages.
The primate's sad, sorrowful eyes will be the first to be plucked out, then sold to cosmetic companies around the world for use in the testing of mascara and artificial tears. Next, the monkey's fur will be stripped away from their limp corpses and sewn together to form pillows and comforters.
Mr. Zebra thought he was going to take a nice drink, but you never know who's going to eat when you're dining in Mother Nature's restaurant. Ouch! That's gotta hurt! And what does this bald eagle want to serve with his kidney beans and a fine gyaki? It's an eel! Ouch! And again, ouch! Ouch! Looks like old Mr. Crocodile wanted some antelope to clear that salty zebra from his palate.
Harold resolutely ignores the phone and the post arriving. Harold looks at his watch. The face flashes with chevrons that seem to point towards the window. A huge grappling claw of a demolition crane smashes through the corner of the apartment and gropes towards Harold. He climbs up the sofa back and squeezes against the wall. Like the jaws of some huge dinosaur, the claw chomps on the television and the coffee table. The crane's hydraulic arm withdraws, leaving a gaping hole in the corner of the first floor apartment. Harold looks out and waves. On the lawn below are several men in yellow hard hats.
Hey! 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 What are you doing?
Holy crap in hell.
What the hell is that?
Stop the crane.
Stop the crane!
Stop the crane!
Hey! Hey, what are you doing?
Us. What are you doing?
I was watching TV.
Well, we're demolishing this place.
Are you nuts? I live here!
Is that a TV?
Yes, that's a TV! It's my TV!
Well, what's your TV doing in there?
I said I live here, stupid! It's where I keep my stuff! My name's on the goddamn buzzer! Harold Crick, apartment 2B, 1893 McCarthy?
Did you say 1893?
Yes!
Oh. Whoops.
The demolition crane drops its load.
I'm not exactly sure it was plot. I was hoping you'd say it was just a really bad coincidence.
Meeting an insurance agent the day your policy runs out is coincidence. Getting a letter from the Emperor saying that he's visiting is plot. Having your apartment eaten by a wrecking ball is something else entirely. Harold, you don't control your fate.
I know.
You do? Okay, come with me. Hey, Tom, can you leave that till tomorrow?
Oh, sure.
You were right. This narrator might very well kill you, so I humbly suggest that you just forget all this and go live your life.
Hilbert walks off.
To live my life? I am living my life. I'd like to continue to live my life.
I know, of course. I mean, all of it. However long you have left. You know, I mean, Howard, you could use it to have an adventure, invent something, or just finish reading Crime and Punishment. Hell, Harold, you could just eat nothing but pancakes if you want.
What's wrong with you? Hey, I don't want to eat nothing but pancakes. I want to live. I mean, who in their right mind on a choice between pancakes and living chooses pancakes?
Harold, if you'd pause to think, I believe you'd realize that that answer is inextricably contingent upon the type of life being led and, of course, the quality of the pancakes.
You don't understand what I'm saying.
Harold nods slowly.
Yes, I do. But you have to understand that this isn't a philosophy or a literary theory or a story to me. It's my life.
Absolutely.
So just go make it the one you've always wanted.
Hilbert strolls off across the campus. In the bakery, Anna is serving the bearded homeless person.
I never expected that they would have
to.
I want two.
She grins at him. Across the street, Harold, carrying his briefcase and a wheelie suitcase, watches her through the circular window. Later, he moves into Dave's white space-age apartment.
All right, so here's your room. Or as I like to call it, Sleep Pod 2. Thanks, Dave.
No problem, dude. It'll be nice having you around.
How long you plan on staying again?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
That evening at the dinner table, Dave reads a paper as he eats.
Dave, can I pose a somewhat abstract, purely hypothetical question?
Sure.
If you knew you were going to die, possibly soon, what would you do?
Dave blinks behind his spectacles.
Well, I don't know. Am I the richest man in the world?
No, you're you.
Do I have a superpower?
No, you're you.
I'm not me. But do I have a superpower?
No, why would you have a superpower?
I don't know, you said it was hypothetical.
Fine, yes, you're really good at math.
That's not a power, that's a skill.
Okay, you're good at math and you're invisible. And you know you're gonna die.
Okay. That's easy, I'd get a space camp.
Space camp?
Yeah, that's in Alabama. It's where kids go to learn how to become astronauts. I've always wanted to go since I was 9.
You're invisible and you'd go to space camp?
I didn't pick invisible, you picked invisible.
Aren't you too old to go to space camp?
You're never too old to go to space camp, dude.
Harold considers this literally and seriously. The next morning in the bathroom, he brushes his teeth in his usual methodical way. He takes the toothbrush from his mouth, looks at it, and starts brushing again. In the city centre, Harold stands in a guitar shop looking round at the merchandise.
Space camp.
122 guitars. 732 strings. 257 pickups. 189 volume knobs. Here Harold stood, face to face with his oldest desire. And stand is almost all Harold did. It wasn't just about finding a guitar. It was about finding a guitar that said something about Harold. Unfortunately, this guitar said, "When I get back to Georgia, that woman gonna feel my pain."
He looks at another display.
This one said something along the lines of,
"Why, yes, these pants are Lycra."
These said, "I'm very sensitive, very caring, and I have absolutely no idea how to play the guitar."
He looks at a double-necked electric guitar.
"I'm compensating for something. Guess what?"
Out of the corner of his eye, he catches sight of another display.
And then Harold saw it. A damaged and terribly mistreated seafoam green Fender staring back at him. Despite its obvious maladies, the guitar spoke with conviction and swagger. In fact, it looked Harold directly in the eye and very plainly stated, "I rock."
In a hospital emergency room, Kate and Penny are observing.
There you go.
Shot in a gang fight. Harold's not in a gang.
Man and tweet.
They look at an elderly man standing by a pillar.
There's nothing wrong with him. He just likes to commit sick people.
Oddly spoken with disdain.
This isn't working.
What? I don't even know why we're here. In fact, I don't even think we're supposed to be in here.
You said I needed visual stimuli.
I meant a museum.
I don't need a goddamn museum. I need the infirm.
You are the infirm.
You know, you're right. The problem is, these people aren't dead. They're just severely injured. Excuse me, where are the dying people?
Kay addresses a nurse.
Most of these people are sick or injured, which is great, don't get me wrong, but they're going to get better, which doesn't really help me. So is there any way to see the people who aren't going to get better?
Excuse me?
I'd like to see, if at all possible, the ones who aren't going to make it, you know, the dead for sure ones.
I'm sorry, are you suffering from anything?
Just writer's block.
Penny strolls off, and she and the man who likes seeing sick people exchange a nod. In Dave's apartment, Harold turns his guitar amp up to 10.
With every awkward strum, Harold Crick became stronger in who he was, what he wanted, and why he was alive. Harold no longer ate alone. He no longer counted brush strokes.
Harold?
He no longer wore neckties.
Right up.
And therefore no longer worried about the time it took to put them on.
Harold walks to a cinema.
He no longer counted his steps to the bus stop.
And watches the meaning of life.
Instead, Harold did that which had terrified him before. That which had eluded him Monday through Friday for so many years. That which the unrelenting lyrics of numerous punk rock songs told him to do. Harold Crick lived his life.
Harold rides the lift back to Dave's apartment, practices his guitar into the night, and goes to bed under a duvet of stars and galaxies.
But despite resuscitating his life, reviving his hope, and instilling a few wicked calluses, Harold's journey was still incomplete. And Harold's wristwatch wasn't about to let him miss another opportunity.
He puts his watch down on Anna's audit card. As Anna leaves the bakery, Harold runs up with a cardboard tray of packages.
Mr. Crick?
Hi.
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 I'm glad I caught you.
Oh, yeah? Why?
Because I wanted to bring these to you.
Really?
Yeah.
So, you can't accept gifts, but you can give them?
Listen.
Oh, that seems a little inconsistent, doesn't it, Mr. Crick?
Very inconsistent.
No, I'll tell you what. I'll purchase them.
No.
No, really. I'd like to purchase them. What are they?
Flowers.
What?
I brought you flowers.
Anna looks at the 10 brown packages in the cardboard tray. Each one is a different type of flower for cooking, and that makes her smile.
And you carried them all the way here?
Miss Pascal, I've been odd. And I know that I've been odd. And I want you.
What?
There are so many reasons. There's so many influences in my life that are telling me at times, quite literally, that I should have come here and bring you these, but I'm doing this because I want you.
You want me?
In no uncertain terms.
Well, isn't there some very clear and established rule about fraternization?
Auditor, oddity, protocol?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't care.
Why?
Because I want you.
She stands with her arms folded, trying to figure him out.
Well, do you mind carrying those a little bit further?
Okay.
Okay.
She looks at the packages and smiles at Harold. They catch a bus, then stroll under the street lamps to Anna's apartment.
Did you make a key?
No, I just committed it to memory. The blue, that's barley flower.
What's that one?
The orange?
Yeah.
Forget.
Right here.
At the bottom of her front doorsteps, she turns to him.
Do you want to come up?
He glances at the door, his face serious.
To your place?
Yeah.
I guess. I could.
Wasn't that the idea with the flowers and everything?
Honestly, I only figured it out up to I want you.
Listen, Mr. Crick. I think I like you. And before I do anything rash, I'd like to make sure. I'd like you to come up.
I'd be honored.
Great.
They sit at a table, eating and drinking wine.
Yeah, he was nuts, though. He got caught when he tried to get the contract notarized.
No!
Harold finishes what's on his plate.
Is it good?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome. No, I'm just going to put him in the sink. Go sit down in the couch.
Anna goes into the kitchen. Her apartment, lit by multicolored lights, is decorated with an oddball flair that reflects her personality. Harold notices a guitar on the sofa.
So do you play the guitar?
What?
Do you play the guitar?
Terribly. Someone traded me that for a wedding cake. Oh, does that mean I have to claim it on my taxes now?
No, I'll leave it out of my final report.
Oh, thanks. Do you play?
Not really. I only know one song.
Oh, play it.
No, I don't know it that well, actually.
No, come on. I promise I'm not going to laugh at you. Play it.
No. Maybe some other time.
All right.
She goes back into the kitchen. Harold perches on the sofa, his elbows on his knees, his hands clasped together, and glances at the guitar by his side. Anna turns on a squeaky tap and rinses the dishes. Harold picks up the guitar and inspects it. He puts it on his knee, positions his fingers on the fretboard, and starts to play, his eyes tightly closed. Anna looks up in surprise and comes into the living room, a look of growing intrigue spreading across her face.
My mama said to me,
leans against the pillow, looking intently at Harold, and starts to mouth the words. Harold doesn't realize she's in the room. She perches on the other end of the sofa. His eyes flicker open slowly. With a besotted smile, Anna clasps his head in her hands and kisses him. Falls to the floor, Harold gradually loosens up, Anna straddles his lap, and the kissing goes on.
Miss Pascal, I...
I know. I want you to. I go the whole wide
world, I go the whole wide world. She strips off her cardigan and tugs Harold's sensible rust-coloured jumper up over his head. Anna's strappy top exposes the big tattoo on her right shoulder and arm. Later, Harold's brogues lie at the foot of Anna's bed. Anna is asleep. Harold is gazing up at the ceiling.
Harold's life was filled with moments both significant and mundane. But to Harold, those moments remained entirely indistinguishable. Except for this. As Anna let out a soft sigh and repositioned herself against him, Harold knew somewhere in his heart that this was one of the significant moments. He knew she was falling in love with him.
Professor Hilbert, it's a comedy.
What?
A comedy. The woman, the one who hates me, Anna Pascal.
Oh.
Last night?
Yeah.
She's falling in love with me.
She is.
It's like a miracle. The voice confirmed it in the middle of the night.
Well, that's wonderful, Harold. I mean, it completely nullifies my list, but, Harold, that's fantastic.
What list?
Well, these are seven living authors whose prior work would seem to make them likely candidates to write your story based on the criteria you and I previously determined. If your narrator is alive, she's on this list.
Wow.
But it appears the list is of little use to you now, now that you're going to live happily ever after. Oh, goody. This woman, Karen Eiffel, is one of my favorite authors.
She's on TV.
Beautiful tragedy, just beautiful. Anyway, let me quickly copy this list for you, just in case.
Hilbert puts down his coffee and leans over his desk.
Sociopathic awesome.
I just wanted to thank you.
Of course. Listen, please. You must tell me if you hear the voice of the narrator again, just for my own edification.
I will.
A Hartwell. It's called Death and Taxes.
Wow. You know, I'm from Texas.
No. Not Texas. Taxes. Death and Taxes. Death and Taxes.
Oh.
Taxes.
Like the Benjamin Franklin boat.
Precisely so.
This lady's the package, I'm telling you. Tell us, what is this next book going to be about?
It's about interconnectivity, mm-hmm. The looming certainty of death, men's fashion accessories.
Oh,
my God, that's her.
What?
That's the voice, she's the narrator, that's her.
No, that can't be right.
No, I'm positive.
Harold, this interview's a decade old.
I didn't think anyone actually wore cufflinks anymore, do they?
Oh, that's her.
Well, where I'm from.
She's British?
She's her. Karen Eiffel. Professor Hilbert, I know that voice.
Crap.
What's wrong?
First of all, she wasn't on my list.
Oh, well.
I figured you would have mentioned the accent, and she doesn't, she kills people.
What?
In every book, the books are all about, they die, she kills them.
Kills who?
Heroes.
It's about a girl who loses several members of her family in quick succession. So the veils.
Where is she?
She's untraceable. Believe me, I didn't teach a class on her. I've written her letters. I mean, she's a hermit. She's a recluse. Here. It's the last book she wrote. Look at the copyright. She hasn't published anything in 10 years.
You said she had to have knowledge of the city. Does she live here?
She used to, yes, but, I mean, she doesn't...
Banneker Press, 2267 Wallace Street?
Harold.
Is that her publisher?
You're not listening to me. I said, even if you find her, she's not getting... Harold.
I'm going to do something. Harold. Thank you for your help.
Harold, she only writes tragedies. I don't believe in
God. Kay Eiffel comes out of a small corner shop with three packs of cigarettes in her hands and opens one of them. A young store assistant is arranging a pyramid of large green apples on a tray. Several apples fall off onto the pavement, and one rolls slowly along the gutter past Kay's feet. She stares at it, unlit cigarette in hand. The boy picks the apple up. In Kay's apartment, Penny is arranging a series of index cards on the marble floor of one of the rooms. Kay comes in with a yellow pad of paper in her hand, holding a plastic cup to her mouth.
Okay. Where you been?
I went out to buy cigarettes, and I figured out how to kill Harold Crink.
Buying cigarettes?
When I came out of the store, it came to me.
How?
Well, Penny, like anything worth writing, it came inexplicably and without method.
I see. Then what happens?
It's perfect, actually. I can't believe I didn't think of it earlier. It's simple, ironic, possibly heartbreaking.
Is that it?
Yes.
You wrote it on legal sheets?
On the bus.
Well, then.
Kay sucks the top of her pen.
So, I'll finish it today.
She backs into the next room, her eyes bulging.
I'll let the publishers know. I'll begin packing my things.
Appreciate it.
Kay goes over to her desk. Penny watches her, shrewdly. Harold comes through a revolving door into the stark marble foyer of Banneker Press and, quickening his pace, crosses to a receptionist sitting behind a counter.
Hi. Hello. Hi.
May I help you?
I need to speak to Karen Eiffel.
I'm sorry?
Karen Eiffel? She's one of your authors. I need to talk to her. It's urgent.
Well, sir, she's not here.
No, I know. I need to find her. I need to know where she is.
We're just the publishers.
Right. Of course. But there must be a way that I could contact her.
We have the address where her fan mail is sent.
No, I can't send mail. It's urgent.
How do you know her?
I'm her brother.
Her brother?
Her brother-in-law.
She has a sister.
No, I'm married. I'm married to her brother. Not in this state, the one over.
The woman stands.
Sir, I'm going to have to ask you to leave.
No. Okay. Listen. I'm one of her characters. I'm new. I'm in her new book.
Oh.
And she's going to kill me. Not actually, but in the book. But I think it'll actually kill me, so I need to talk to her and ask her to stop.
The woman's dark eyes and fixed mouth give nothing away. Harold steps through a revolving door into the sunshine, and an idea stops him in his tracks. He steps out of the lift into his IRS office.
Hi, Harold. Nice sweater.
People glance up as he hurries past the office cubicles.
Hi, Harold. Phones are out.
Hey, Harold, 19% of 4,000.
He bumps into a woman, but hurries on.
Hey, Harold. Back from your vacay?
Hey, looking good.
Company looks terrible.
Yeah, banged up.
Wherever you went, I do not want to go.
Hey, Harold.
Put me not there.
He sits at his computer.
He's totally ignoring me.
He scribbles on a post-it and gets up.
Look at this now.
Sit
down. There you go.
That was good having you.
Harold runs to the printer, grabs a piece of paper it has just printed out, and runs to the filing room. He searches through a box of files, pulls out a folder, looks at the top page, takes it back into his cubicle at the office, and picks up the phone. Dave comes up.
Oh, dude, the phones are out.
Can I borrow your cell phone?
Oh, the signal's down.
Damn it. You all right?
Dave, I need a favor.
Sure, what is it?
Can I have some change?
Within moments, Harold found himself running across the plaza, heading for the nearest paper. At last, he spotted it. But as Harold neared the phone, he saw it was occupied by a nearsighted octogenarian determined to reach his daughter in Denver, no matter how many quarters it took. Fortunately, Harold remembered a bank of phones in the 6th Street subway tunnel.
The baby girl's name isn't Mrs. Epstein. My daughter's name is Mrs. Epstein.
Harold runs downstairs into the subway. With a sheet of paper in his hand, he races between the white-tiled walls towards the bank of three phones. The tunnel seems endless.
The first phone failed to give a dial tone, and the second seemed to be splattered with a fresh batch of mucus. Harold dialed the third phone, fervently making sure to give each number key a specific, forceful push.
K-types. The phone rang. Penny, clearing her things in the furthest empty room, glances at the phone. Kay looks up with a puzzled frown and types. The phone rang again. Penny goes to the phone.
You would answer that!
You say this phone number.
Penny raises her hands, shrugs, okay, and goes back to her packing. Kay can see the phone from her desk. Staring at it, she presses the carriage return on the typewriter and types, the phone rang a third time, but without typing the final full stop. She looks up and jabs the full stop key. She races into the far room and snatches up the phone.
Hello?
Is this Karen Eiffel?
Yes.
My name is Harold Crick. I believe you're writing a story about me.
I'm sorry?
My name is Harold Crick.
Is this a joke?
No, I work for the IRS. My name, Miss Eiffel, is Harold Crick, and when I go through the files at work, I hear a deep and endless ocean.
Kay drops the phone.
Miss Eiffel? Hello? Miss Eiffel, hello?
Let him in.
Penny is sitting at Kay's typewriter in the first of the three white, sparse rooms. Kay is in the last room, sitting in a high-back upholstered chair.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm Penny. I'm Kay's assistant.
Oh, I'm Harold, her main character.
She looks at him with an intrigued smile and beckons him in. He's still wearing the rust-coloured sweater over his partly untucked open-neck shirt and blue jeans. Kay, sitting bolt upright, waits apprehensively for him to appear in the far doorway.
Oh, my God.
She gets up.
Oh, my God.
Her eyes widen.
Oh, my God. Oh.
And she backs away into the corner of the room.
Miss Eiffel?
Your hair. Your eyes.
She kneels.
Your shoes.
She gazes at his feet.
Hello.
Slowly, she raises her eyes to his face.
I'm Harold Crick.
I know.
Later, she's smoking.
How did you find me?
We audited you a little more than 10 years ago, and your number was in the file.
I'm sorry, but this is... incredibly strange.
You're telling me.
Didn't you think you were crazy?
Sort of. But then you were right about everything. Like, everything. And then you said, little did he know.
Little did he know?
Yeah. It's a third-person omniscient.
Jesus.
Which meant it was, well, you know, someone other than me. At least that's what Professor Hilbert said.
Professor Hilbert? Professor Jules Hilbert.
Yeah. Yeah, he loves your books.
I love his letters.
She sits at a desk.
So you understand why I had to find you and ask you not to kill me.
What?
I mean, obviously, you haven't written the end.
Harold.
I mean, now, since we've met and you can see that I exist, you're not going to kill me, right? Have you written it?
No.
Have you written
it? An outline.
Okay, but it's just an outline, right?
Yeah, sort of.
Sort of?
Yeah, it's just not typed.
Not typed?
Maybe that's okay.
What does that mean?
I'm sorry.
What do you mean it's okay?
I don't know the rules. I'm just trying to write a book.
What do you mean you're sorry?
Okay. Let him read it. Let him read it.
Penny has the pages of yellow legal paper in her hand. Professor Hilbert sits in a lifeguard's chair at the university swimming pool, reading a novel wrapped in a polythene bag. Harold comes trotting up with a manuscript folder.
You find her?
Yeah.
And?
I may already be dead. Just not typed.
Is that it?
Harold nods.
Did you read it?
I tried, but I couldn't.
Didn't.
You have to read it. You have to tell me what to do or what not to do. If I can avoid it, if I have a chance, please.
He proffers up the bulky folder.
Hmm.
Harold hands Hilbert the folder. Professor Hilbert drops it onto the lower platform of the guard chair. Harold slowly turns and walks away around the edge of the pool. He glances back at the professor, who's buried in his own reading. Hilbert reaches down for the manuscript folder and undoes the tie. In an office, the woman who circled the job vacancies in the newspaper is handed a bus driver's uniform.
And here's your uniform. It's a go. Bananas outside, she will sign your
uniform. Outside a suburban house, the boy's father helps fasten his son's safety helmets and watches him proudly cycle away on his new bike. After dark, Harold lies wide awake beside Anna, who's fast asleep. Professor Hilbert sits down in his glass-walled office and takes out Kay's typescript. The title page reads, Death and Taxes, a novel by Karen Eiffel. He puts on his spectacles. The professor loosens his tie as he reads. Harold lies awake, gazing at the ceiling. The following day, Professor Hilbert stands in a glass-walled alcove looking out at a courtyard. Harold, in a sensible blue V-neck sweater and grey slacks, comes up behind him looking apprehensive.
Professor Hilbert?
Hilbert turns.
Hi, Harold.
Hi.
The professor looks haggard.
Look tired.
No, just calm.
Hilbert nods gravely.
Harold, I'm sorry.
Harold bites his lip.
You have to die.
What?
It's a masterpiece. It's possibly the most important novel in her already stunning career. It's absolutely no good unless you die at the end. I've been over it again and again, and I know how hard this is for you to hear.
You're asking me to knowingly face my death?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Harold slumps down into a square leather armchair and looks around dazedly.
I thought you'd find something.
I'm sorry, Harold.
Can't we just try and to see if she can change it?
No.
No?
Harold, in the grand scheme, it wouldn't matter.
Yes, it would.
No.
I could change. I could quit my job. I could go away with Anna. I could be someone else.
Harold, listen to me.
I can't die right now. It's just a really bad timing.
Hilbert nods understandingly.
No one wants to die, Harold, but unfortunately we do. Harold? Harold, listen to me. Harold, you will die someday, sometime. Heart failure at the bank. Choke on a mint. Some long, drawn-out disease you contracted on vacation. You will die. You will absolutely die. Even if you avoid this death, another will find you. And I guarantee that it won't be nearly as poetic or meaningful as what she's written.
Tears trickle down Harold's face.
I'm sorry, but it's the nature of all tragedies, Harold. The hero dies. But the story goes on forever.
On a bus back from the university, Harold opens up the document folder. He takes out the unfinished typescript and the handwritten ending on yellow legal paper and starts to read.
A
As he finishes each page, he puts it on the seat next to him. Passengers get on and off as the bus continues. Despite the many empty seats, a man demands the seat next to Harold.
No, I don't want to sit down. I want to sit down over here.
Harold keeps reading. Eventually, there's no one else on the bus. It pulls into the depot and through the automatic wash. The bus parks in the cavernous depot. Penny comes into Kay's apartment. The desk is overturned. The typewriter and table lamp are on the floor.
Kay?
Kay is in the middle of the three rooms, lying on her back on her large black desk, a cigarette and a tissue at her side. The floor is strewn with sheets of paper. Penny comes over.
Kay?
Kay opens her eyes.
How many people do you think I've killed?
Kay?
How many?
I don't know.
Eight.
Kay, get
up. I've killed eight people. I counted.
They're fictional. Get up.
Harold Crick isn't fictional.
Harold Crick?
He isn't fictional, Penny. Every book I've ever written ends with someone dying. Everyone. Really nice people, too. The book about Helen, the school teacher. I killed her the day before summer vacation. How cruel is that? And the civil engineer, Edward, the one I trapped, with a heart attack in rush hour. I killed him.
Her eyes well up.
I killed. Penny, I killed them all.
Darkness falls and the bus comes out for the night shift. Harold is still sitting in the same seat reading. He arrives at the yellow handwritten pages. He finishes the novel. He holds the manuscript on his lap for a moment, gazing ahead, then puts it carefully back in the folder. Kay comes out of her building, clutching her bag under her arm, just as the bus drops Harold off outside.
Disciple! Hi. I just finished it.
You just...
Yeah, I read it all in one read on the bus. It's lovely. I like the part about the guitars.
Thanks. Good. Well,
look,
listen, I'm...
No, I read it and I loved it. And there's only one way it can end. I mean, I don't have much background in literary anything, but this seems simple enough.
He presses the folder into her hand.
I love your book, and I think you should finish it.
She watches him turn and walk away, leaving her stunned. A cleaner is hoovering the IRS office. Harold passes behind him on the way to his cubicle.
The night before his death, Harold unsuspectingly went about some usual business. He finished his outstanding audits. He made a few phone calls he had been putting off.
Listen, does your program have an age limit?
And he travelled to Ms. Pascal's, where she made him meatloaf and chocolate pudding, and the two watched old movies. It was a nice enough evening, and in any other circumstance it would have seemed commonplace. In fact, the only thing that made this night significant was the morning it preceded.
Anna and Harold lie in bed side by side. She snuggles up to him.
I have to tell you something.
You
do.
Is it a secret?
Sort of.
She lies back, putting her ear close to his mouth.
I adore you.
I adore you too. Is that it?
No. I have to tell you this. I just want you to listen carefully.
Okay.
He leans over her.
You can deduct the value of all the food you give away as a charitable contribution.
Harold.
It amounts to more than what you're currently withholding. And it doesn't break any tax laws.
Harold, the point is to break the tax laws.
I want to make the world a better place too, Anna. I think that means keeping you out of jail.
Later, Harold picks up his watch from the bedside table. Anna is asleep. He kisses her on the cheek and turns out the bedside light. In the grey light of dawn, he walks back to his apartment. He steps inside and looks at the far corner of the living room. The gaping hole torn by the demolition crane is covered with a thick polythene sheet tacked over a wooden frame. Harold goes to what used to be the window and looks out. The watch on his wrist glows blue as the morning alarm goes off. An alarm goes off in the bedroom of the young cyclist. Harold, staring into the bedroom mirror, mechanically puts on a smart blue and white tie. The newly hired bus driver gets out of her bed. The boy comes downstairs. Harold puts on a smart blue suit jacket and straightens the tie. The bus driver puts on her work jacket and opens her front door. Harold comes into his kitchen and selects a large green apple.
Much had changed for Harold over the past few weeks. His attitude towards work, his habitual counting, his love life.
The bus driver clocks in.
But of all the transmutations Harold Crick had undergone, perhaps the most significant was that today, on his return to work, he was not late for the 8:17 Kronecker bus. What Harold had not understood about that Wednesday 4 weeks prior was that the time he received from his fellow commuter was, in fact, 3 full minutes later than the actual time, and therefore 3 full minutes later than the time to which his watch and life had been previously set. Not the worst of errors. But if Harold had not set his watch to the incorrect time, Harold would have again barely caught the 8:17 Kronecker bus, and he would not be approaching the bus stop precisely at 8:14 this particular Friday.
Harold joins the crowd waiting for the bus. Down the street, the boy rides along the pavement.
Harold?
An otherwise ignorable fact. Until the unthinkable occurred.
The boy falls off his bike in the path of a bus. Harold pushes him to safety. The bus, driven by the new driver, runs Harold down. As he falls, his half-eaten apple rolls into the gutter. At her desk, Kay unwraps a cigarette from her tissue. Her hands tremble as she fumbles with the lighter. She slams the desk and grips the typewriter. The page in the typewriter reads, Harold Crick was... The word dead is half written.
What happened? It wasn't your fault. He was trying to help the little boy. Get your supervisor on the phone.
I don't believe it.
I don't think you want to go any further than
this. Is he okay?
No, it looks like he's breathing.
I don't think he's breathing.
On the street, the bus driver cries into her phone. In her bedroom, Anna wakes, sits up and looks around. Kay stares blankly at the milky white walls in her apartment. Professor Hilbert sits in his book-lined office, gazing out over the campus.
Man.
Kay comes in with a manuscript folder.
Excuse me.
Hilbert turns round.
Are you Professor Hilbert?
Yes.
Hi. I'm Karen Eiffel. I believe we have a mutual acquaintance.
Please sit down.
I just came by to...
She puts the folder on a table.
Is that it?
Yes. Have you read it?
Is that all right?
Yes.
They both look at the folder.
I think perhaps you may be interested in the new ending.
Harold is in hospital, bandaged from head to foot and in traction. He opens his eyes. His doctor looks up from his notes.
Good afternoon. Oh, hi. It's a pretty brave thing you did.
Huh?
Stepping in front of that bus is pretty brave. Kind of stupid, but pretty brave.
Oh, yeah. Is that boy okay?
It's just fine, scratched up is all.
Good.
Harold looks down at his bandages.
Am I okay?
Well, you're not dead. On the other hand, it looks like you cracked your head, you broke three bones in your leg and foot, you suffered four broken ribs, fractured your left arm, and severed an artery in your right arm, which should have killed you in a matter of minutes. But amazingly, a shard of metal from your watch obstructed the artery, keeping the blood loss low enough to keep you alive, which is pretty cool.
Wow.
Yeah. So with some physical therapy, a few months of rest, you should be fine. Well, sort of. We weren't able to remove the shard of watch from your arm without risking severe arterial damage, so you'll be okay. You'll just have a piece of watch embedded in your arm the rest of your life. You're very lucky to be alive, Mr. Crick.
Yeah.
A nurse comes in.
Dr. Mercator, Mr. Crick has a visitor.
Sure.
Anna rushes in.
My God. Oh.
She kisses him on the lips.
I'm okay.
Harold.
It's all right.
Harold, you're not fine. Look at you. You're severely injured. What happened?
I stepped in front of a bus.
What? Why?
There was a boy. I had to push him out of the way.
What?
I had to keep this boy from getting hit.
You stepped in front of a bus to save a little boy?
I didn't have a choice.
Professor Hilbert reads the new ending while Kay, her hair washed and wearing a dress, looks out of the window. He puts the last page down and takes off his specs.
It's okay.
It's not great.
No. It's okay. It's not bad. It's not the most amazing piece of English literature in several years, but it's okay.
She touches her toes.
You know, I think I'm fine with okay.
It doesn't make any sense with the rest of the book, though.
No, not yet. I'll rewrite the rest. My assistant said she'd go back to the publisher and request more time.
Why?
I don't know. It's awfully sweet, though.
No, why did you change the book?
Lots of reasons. I realized I just couldn't do it.
Because he's real?
Because it's a book about a man who doesn't know he's about to die and then dies. But if the man does know he's going to die and dies anyway, dies willingly, knowing he could stop it, then, I mean, isn't that the type of man you want to keep alive?
Anna feeds Harold a cookie.
As Harold took a bite of Bavarian sugar cookie, he finally felt as if everything was going to be okay. Sometimes, when we lose ourselves in fear and despair, in routine and constancy, in hopelessness and tragedy, we can thank God for Bavarian sugar cookies. Unfortunately, when there aren't any cookies, we can still find reassurance in a familiar hand on our skin, or a kind and loving gesture.
Dave opens an envelope. It's a brochure for Space Camp.
Or a subtle encouragement.
Penny puts a box of nicotine patches on Kay's typewriter.
Or a loving embrace.
The father hugs his boy.
Or an offer of comfort.
The bus driver's friends hug her.
Not to mention hospital gurneys
The ER room.
And nose plugs.
Professor Hilbert puts on a nose plug, strips down to his orange trunks and jumps into the pool.
And uneaten Danish.
The tramp at the coffee shop.
And soft-spoken secrets.
Anna and Harold lie in bed.
And Fender Stratocasters. And maybe the occasional piece of fiction. And we must remember that all these things, the nuances, the anomalies, the subtleties, which we assume only accessorize our days, are in fact here for a much larger and nobler cause. They are here to save our lives. I know the idea seems strange, but I also know that it just so happens to be true. And so it was. A wristwatch saved Harold Crick.
Below these words on the last page of the typescript are two final words. The end.